Today on this episode of We'll Work for Purpose, I'm joined by Michael Hilliard, who is a podcaster and conflict journalist. His show is called The Red Line Podcast, which has amassed over 500,000 streams. He himself has some pretty interesting stories, as his conflict journalism has led him into some pretty shady areas. In this episode, we talk about social media, politics, and the mindset he has when he does his work. So without further ado, please enjoy the third episode of We'll Work for Purpose. On the third episode of the Will Work for Purpose podcast today, we're joined by Michael Hilliard, who is the host of the Red Line podcast and a conflict journalist by trade. Michael, how are you doing?
Not too bad. How are you this evening?
Awesome. I'm doing good this morning. You contacted me on Twitter. We kind of connected on Twitter, and you're the host of the Red Line podcast, which is a geopolitical podcast. How exactly did you get started doing that podcast?
It was actually a really weird kind of story to get into it. I've been sort of a conflict journalist and writing, ghostwriting for people for a long time, mostly to do with defense and, just kind of war zones around the world. And so I had this weird black book of people I'd met through my travels of being Iran, Russia, and Kyrgyzstan and Uzbekistan. You know, I had friends who worked at the White House, and I had friends who worked for the Taliban, and it was kind of this weird, I had to do something with this list of contacts, So it was, let's do a show where we can get the Taliban on and ask him, hey, what's the deal with the war? So I was approached by other guys like, look, we should do this show. And I said, yep, let's do it just as a side thing. And then it kind of took off from there, and it got a lot bigger than I thought it ever would. Effectively now the show is just me talking to some very smart people around the world and about what's going on and how a lot of these tiny war zones that we don't really think about actually have huge ramifications down the track.
And so I guess this kind of is all predicated on you being a conflict journalist. And so when you were going through primary school and you're coming up in your education and things like that, how were you ever at any point what I want to do? I want to go into the most sketchy places on earth and talk to sketchy people about really dangerous topics. And then I'm going to report on them. Were you ever thinking that coming up, or was it just kind of,
I grew up in a sketchy neighborhood, but I think I never thought this would be the way I'd go. When I was a little kid, I wanted to be a paleontologist of all things. But it wasn't until I started traveling through some of these zones and feeling pretty comfortable, going through Russia was the first place I went, this is actually really interesting. There's a lot of interesting people. Cause when you get to, a bar in, rural Uzbekistan, the only people in that bar are arms dealers, drug dealers, journalists, armed militias, and idiots. And usually I'm the idiot, but quite often you meet some really interesting people in bars like that.
What keeps you going back, basically? What keeps you interested in it, or what keeps you kind of willing to subject yourself to those levels of conversation and in those areas, I assume, how long have you been kind of doing this line of work?
Well, I've been doing journalism for now 10 years, but I actually started as a music journalist. I was playing in bands and, interviewing guys like the Arctic Monkeys and kind of just that was my job back in the day. I've been doing conflict stuff for about 5 years now. It's an incredibly different world. But I think what really, kept me going back to it was, A, it's cheap vodka. All these places are very, very cheap booze. But B, and mostly is the fact that, this is where you really understand how the world kind of works. Mm. When you watch a press conference from a general, he's a guy who's done a lot of PR, and he'll actually give you the very glossed over version of how the conflict's going. Whereas you meet with his undersecretary who's in a bar, and he will actually tell you how the war's going. But to get in that place and meet that person, there's a lot of visa troubles and always a lot of headache going through.
And you talked about better understanding how the world works and kind of developing a better understanding of these wars and their implications on foreign relations, politics on a global level. Were you always interested in how things work? Is this kind of just an outworking of some pre-existing, you wanted to be a paleontologist, that's a scientific discipline, mm-hmm. So that's kind of trying to understand the world in a
sort of under in a different medium, I guess. Were you kind of always interested in the way things worked, or, you know, again, is that something that just developed over time?
I mean, yeah, I was always pretty interested in how things work and how, you know, society generally functions. But I think what really got me into it is I grew up in a military household, and I got, you know, grew up with the Russians are the enemy, the Soviets enemy. If you don't be careful, they're coming for you, you know, that kind of environment. And it wasn't until I went to Russia for the first time and met Russians and realized they're actually all lovely people, that kind of sparked a thing in me going, well, what else do I not understand? You know, let's go to these zones and talk to these people. And, you know, like we all kind of look at Iran as this incredibly dangerous regime that's going to destroy us. And when I was in Iran, I can tell you the most dangerous thing about it was the fact that they almost overfed me to death. Their food is amazing, and they will continue, like, you will finish the plate out of politeness and they will restack it out of their politeness. And I think that's the most dangerous thing about Tehran. But yeah, and that's kind of where it came from, is understanding the other side. Because once you kind of have that in your mind that, look, you know, I only understand my perspective of this issue, this conflict, this whatever it is. And as long as you go to the other side of the front lines, you go, oh, okay, no, you're actually fighting for this. And that kind of makes a little bit of sense.
It kind of reminds me of a story I heard. There was this guy who, he might have done a TED talk actually, but he essentially rode his bike around the world. And he said, you know, when I was riding through Germany, they told me to look out for the Russians. When I was riding through Russia, they told me to look out for the Iranians. And when I went through Iran, they told me to look out for the Turks. And I found in each place, they were just as nice as the last people, you know. It's like, I totally agree with you. Like, that experience proves to ring, you know, kind of rings true, and the humanity of people kind of shines through over there. Like, I guess, the I don't know what you call it, the ideological possession of their, like, the state or whatever, you know, like the people aren't the state necessarily or something like that. But, yeah, that's very interesting. And so, like, you started as a music journalist. Do you wish you were still doing that, or are you satisfied being, you know, in the center of conflict and, like, as far as politics?
Doing music journalism is really interesting, because you get to meet all these great artists you really love, but those interviews are very, you know, they're staged. Like, you know, when you get on the phone with someone like the Arctic Monkeys or Exhibit or 50 Cent or one of these guys, you're like the 300th phone call he has to do today that his publicist has set up. And it's effectively, you get to ask about four or five questions that are kind of interesting, and you can make up those questions. And then the other rest of the interview is, so when's the album coming out? What's the album about? Mm. Oh, that sounds really interesting. It's very formulaic interviews, and they give you very formulaic answers. It's why I always try to find something really obscure. Like, I noticed you won second prize in a beauty contest in year four. And they're like, that's something that they haven't been asked. But when you go into conflict journalism, there's a lot, you know, people give much more real stories. They're actually willing to come forward. You know, it's not as forgettable an interview. Like, even I would do four bands in an afternoon. You can kind of just, you get kind of, everything washes over you. Whereas, you know, when you get into sort of conflict journalism, you're either going to get the whitewash statement, what the government's going to give you, or you're going to get a really interesting point of view from, you know, a soldier on the ground who's kind of telling you that, yes, there's no ammunition there, and yes, this, which is always a really interesting place to be.
I can understand that sentiment. Like, I'm not a journalist, I could never do what you do. I would fold, certainly. Like, if I was in a backwoods Russian bar talking to someone with, you know, military secrets, I just don't have the nerves to do something like that. Do you find that, like, I guess when you're in those moments, I don't know how many of those, like, really, really, like, sort of like nail biting moments you've been in, but, like, when you're in that moment, what are you thinking about? Are you like, this is for some greater purpose, or this is for my understanding, or this is for others' understanding? Like sort of, how do you kind of, like, I don't know, count the cost when you're in those moments?
So obviously when you're in those moments, you usually have an escape plan. You usually have some way across the border, or you have somewhere to go, or you have a friend, you know, that you can call and they'll get you out across the border quite quietly. You know, that's, you know, it's, sometimes it's a bit terrifying. Like, you know, of all the people who pointed guns at me, most of them have spoken Russian over the years. But at the same time, you know, that's what you're there for. And you generally have in the back of your head, most people aren't willing to shoot you over asking questions. And majority of the time, even if you ask the wrong questions and annoy someone, a couple of cigarettes and a couple of beers here and there, and just the chat will get you out of it enough that you can go, look, hey man, I'm going to go to the toilet. I'll be back in a minute. And then you can just disappear and head off to the next town. But yeah, there's only like most people are very friendly and they're very nice. And again, most people aren't there to kill you. There's only a couple of times I've needed to, you know, sneak back across a border or get out of town pretty quickly. But most people, you know, everyone has a mother-in-law they don't really like. Everyone's got, you know, a terrible car that the heating doesn't work. You know, everyone's pretty much the same across the world.
Do you have any of those stories you'd be willing to share? Like something that was just wild and you know, like to tell at parties kind of thing?
Yeah, cool. Recently I went to Transnistria, which is this breakaway Soviet republic between Ukraine and Moldova. Effectively, if you wanted to buy a nuke, that's where you'd go. So we're in there. When we came in the border, we got past the peacekeepers and we're in there. And our accommodation was pretty awful. And there's no tourists there. You know, the money is made of plastic. It's weird. They still have hammers and sickles all over the place. But the owner said to me, look, you know, there's no tourists. Don't worry. And then they snuck a KGB agent to kind of watch us as we did everything. And then I met with, you know, after him following around for a couple of days, I then met with my contact who worked with the president, and he had a few drinks. We chatted about a few things. And then he kind of, I said to him, like, hey, there's a KGB guy in my apartment. What's the deal with that? And he goes, well, let me make a call. I'll check for you. And he goes off and he comes back and he goes, yes, you're in problems. You're about to be arrested. Tomorrow morning at 12 o'clock, you will be arrested. And I went, shit. Okay. So at that point, he said, look, don't worry. We'll have you out of prison in 2 weeks. No problem. And I said, well, look, mate, I really don't want to go to prison here. And my lovely girlfriend decided to come on this trip with me. So my lovely girlfriend's in this bar. She doesn't speak any Russian, so she doesn't understand the conversations going on. And he went, look, I have this arms dealer friend of mine who has a deal with customs. He can get you across the border. And I said, okay, cool, let's do it. So I had to tell my lovely girlfriend and convince her to get in the back of a car and then sort of bob down as we snuck back across the border through the peacekeepers a couple of hours before we were about to be arrested. And then sneak back into Moldova, which I don't think anyone has ever said the phrase, thank God we're back in Moldova. But
yeah, I think that's a sentence that's probably never been said.
I mean, Moldova is lovely, you know, it's a great country, but yeah, like it was sneaking out and telling our little Russian, our KGB guys, like, oh, we're going to Ukraine, you know, tricking him and then quickly escaping out the country. Before they could arrest us. And then my contact there was like, you should come back in the summer, come to my dacha. I was like,
when you were slipping, like whenever you were, you know, taking part in like essentially like this espionage, like this sort of like covert operation, like were you nervous or what were you thinking at that time?
Well, that's the trick. You can't really be too nervous. You have to kind of keep your wits about you. But you know, if you're freaking out, then they know you're not supposed to be there. And right. If you're scared and panicking and not really willing to be there, then that's when they're going to mess with you. But if you're going in there and you act like, look, I've been in 100 war zones, you don't impress me, you know, that's when they're willing to talk to you like you're a local, like you know what you're doing. So you kind of have to, even as terrified as you are, you have to keep this kind of look about you the whole time.
Was your girlfriend in threat of like giving you away, or was she able to kind of be like stoic, you know, kind of like,
no, she, there's two things at her advantage. A, she doesn't speak Russian, so she doesn't know how bad the situation can be. And B, she's traveled with me on a few of these. So she's been to Ukraine and a few other places with me. She's about to finish her doctorate in psychology, so she can read the room on like, so both of us got a lot of signals between us. Like, this thing's about to pop off. We need to leave. Very quickly. But yeah, she's absolute champ about it all. Awesome. I think her not speaking Russian is probably for the best.
Yeah. Were you in the moment where you're like, no, it's fine. We're going to take a car ride. Like there's no trouble. Like he's going to show us the countryside. Like were you kind of like that? Or were you just like bare bones information? Like
bare bones information until you get back over the border and then you can let the rest go. But there's lots of things. Like I had a guy who was offering to pay to, you know, to buy her. And she's like, oh, what does he say? It sounds lovely. I'm like, oh, just the weather is lovely here. And he says that the fish is great. We need to try the fish. Oh, it wasn't until we kind of got out of that. I was like, look, you know, he was trying to buy, but I said no. But yeah, it's the weird places you go, I guess.
Do you find that like, I guess you do speak Russian. And so do you find that like, I assume you have an accent in Russian, like anyone has an accent whenever they speak another language. Does that ever impede your ability? Like, does that ever like stop or create complications or anything like that?
All the time. So when I'm very sober, you know, my accent is fairly decent. It's a fairly Moscow accent, you know. Я хочу водку, у меня, пожалуйста. You know, it's quite a normal Moscow accent. But when I'm after a few drinks, my accent goes, and all the Australian just twinges back in. It's like, Эда, можно купить два водка, пожалуйста? So Russians always get a kick out of it. My accent is a god awful. And my German now is spoken with a pretty awful Russian accent. So, and I often like slip German, Russian into the sentence. So I would be the worst Russian spy of all time.
So you just mentioned you speak German, Russian, and you obviously speak English. How many other languages do you speak?
I speak a little bit of Malaysian or Indonesian, because that's what we learned in school, weirdly enough. And enough French to order and ask where the toilet is, and that's about it. But I speak all languages pretty badly. Like I speak Russian enough that, you know, I'll have a conversation, but there'll be words I don't know. Like, you know, you're like, can I borrow this thing that you are currently sitting on? Because I don't know the word for chair. But it's also the grammar that gets you in Russian as well.
Yeah, I have a buddy who's studying, he's doing foreign policy at Harvard, and he's doing Russian, and he'll show me some of the, you know, what he's working on in Russian. I'm like, dude, it's like one of the other Asian languages, like a Chinese, Japanese, Korean, like those all, like they have, it's so other than like English, German, French, like those other languages, like, I don't know a lot about languages, but like right now I'm learning German. Me and my wife are learning German. And like a lot of it, you know, it uses English letters at the very least, you know, like sure there are some symbols here and there, like umlauts or whatever, you know, but like it's not so different than Russian or Japanese or Chinese. Like whenever you were learning those languages, well, one, which one did you start with? And two, how long and like what did you do to kind of pick that up?
Well, we did Indonesian in school because, you know, we're Australian, we're very close to Indonesia. That's where everyone goes on holidays. I did German when I left school, and my German now is pretty awful. But Russian was the one after. It's the Russian grammar that gets you. So in English, you'd say, you know, don't be mad, he doesn't know what he's doing. In German, as you'd know, you'd say, be not mad, for he knows not what he does.
Right.
The translation. Whereas Russian is kind of be towards you mad, not him to not knowing towards him now.
Wow.
Like when you hear Russians kind of say in movies, like, you come to a house, yes, and buy chicken big, yes. Like that is exactly how Russian kind of translates. It's a very grammatically, like to the point where you can almost chuck anything in any order and it's like, close enough. Whereas German's very rigid on where the verbs go. And yeah, so yeah, your friend studying Harvard and foreign policy would know all about the niceties of Russian.
Yeah, I can't. He's never struggled with anything before. Like literally, I mean, he can pick up anything and understand it, except for Russian, apparently. So, like, but even then, he's still doing great at it. It's just like, man, it just looks so complicated. But
the useful thing is, it's all phonetic. Like, it's all exactly how it sounds. Like, you read it and it sounds. You know, there's none of this, like the English word for yacht is the most ridiculous nonsense word I've ever seen. Like, Y-A-C-H-T, how does it, it's to be yatched. Explaining, you know, someone learning English, they will look at the word yacht and give up, whereas at least Russian's phonetic.
And so whenever you were learning, like whenever you were, so you started with Malaysian and then you kind of sprouted out in other languages from there. But like whenever you were learning, like, learning Russian or learning German, whenever you were learning those things, were you thinking of your job? Were you thinking, this is going to make me a better conflict journalist? This is going to make me be able to go more places and talk to more people?
Of course. That's kind of where it started. But at the same time, You know, the reason I learned Russian is because before I even got into conflict journalism, a buddy of mine, had a very big night, and we on a whim booked tickets to go to Moscow. And then we both looked at each other and went, one of us should learn Russian or we're going to get killed. And I went, look, I'll do it. You know, how hard could it be? And then kind of went from there. And then when I got there, I spoke Russian. I kind of used the broken Russian I had, and it got us through most of it. So yeah, it kind of kicked off from there.
And are there any other skills that you've had to learn? Like, you know, well, I have to learn how to hotwire a car. I have to learn how to, you know, I don't know, survive in a Russian winter. Like, are there any like other odd skills you've picked up like doing this job?
There's lots of weird skills you pick up. How to survive in a Russian winter. You keep a sort of 2 vodka minimum across you the entire day. Mm. That's how you get through it. and wear lots and lots and lots of layers. Like, you know, when I go outside, when it's, you know, negative 25 or negative 30, especially being Australian with a cold day is like, you know, 9 degrees Celsius, which is what in Fahrenheit, whatever it is in Fahrenheit. Yeah, because like my state particularly, I live in a desert state here in Australia where summer here gets to about 115, 118 Fahrenheit.
Mm-hmm.
So it's, you know, for me, cold is cold. Yeah. But yeah, it's, you know, thermals, shirt, collared shirt, cardigan, jacket, hat, gloves, you know, you put on like 1800 layers of clothing just to go outside.
Wow. Yeah. So, I mean, like, to me, being a conflict journalist in a lot of ways sounds like being a spy to a certain degree. Would you say, like, from what I've heard so far, like I'm literally envisioning you as, you know, an agent, you know, in some, you know, foreign government going in and infiltrating and interviewing these people and doing all this stuff. Like,
well, spies get paid far better. Okay. And also spies aren't quite allowed to drink as much on the job usually. Effectively, being a conflict journalist is literally just shaking hands all the time. And just making, it's literally just a, you know, Kentucky, but really cheap. You're just going and making friends, shaking hands. You're making sure you're friendly and you can drink just a little bit more than the other guy. That's effectively the job title. As much as we pretend we're all glorified, you know, seekers of truth, we're just people who are too, you know, we're too cheap to holiday in Paris.
That reminds me, there is like a fad going on, like dark tourism, where they go to all these, like, instead of going to a nice place, they go to like Cannibal Island or something crazy, you know, and like they kind of, instead of seeing nice things, they see horrible things. I wonder if that's a bigger industry. Would you be interested in doing something like that?
I have been sent that cannibal. I've sent that dark tourism thing about a gazillion times.
It's
very close to what I do. Mm-hmm. And yeah, like that's the thing. It's much more interesting areas of the world. You know, a lot of these places are, we look at it like it's just, you know, like Kazakhstan, for instance, is a fantastically lovely country. There are bits of Kazakhstan that are nicer than my hometown. But you know, you tell someone, oh, I'm going to Kazakhstan for a few weeks, they all think you're about to die because it's got the word Stan at the end, where it's actually a lovely country with, you know, it's very solid. It's no problems at all. Except it's, you know, way in the desert. That's the thing. Like a lot of these, you know, dark tourism places, like even the dark tourism series, most of the places they go to are pretty safe.
I'd imagine that they would, they wouldn't broadcast or advertise anything that people would actually die. And I can only imagine like the type of like, legal disclaimers and legal team that industry probably has around it.
But most people aren't looking to kill you. You know, most
right?
People
that's true.
Anything. Yeah. And here's the thing: even at worst, like when people say to me, "Oh, what if you get mugged in Uzbekistan?" Yes, they can have the $36 worth of currency in my pocket at the moment. It's not, you know, if they mug me, oh, that's not the end of the world, really. Yeah, like unless you go into really harsh areas, like, you know, like it's Somalia, South Sudan, those kind of places where you're a hostage risk, that's a problem. But even then, there are a lot of ways to avoid being captured.
Are you ever worried that, like, with your, like, you have the Redline podcast, are you ever worried that, like, you'll become, I guess, famous enough that people will recognize you? And are you ever worried that recognition would ever do damage to your ability to do your job, basically?
Not particularly. I mean, frankly, I'm not showing my face too much. And even if, you know, when, you know, the thing of doing the show, the bigger the show we've got, the bigger the people coming out of the woodwork are. You know, we've had people from, like, I had a one of the top three guys on NORAD, which is the US Nuclear Missile Command, hit me up. He's like, oh, I love the show. You know, I listened to your piece on this, would love to chat. I was like, okay. You know, not having the show, I never would have had the opportunity to chat to a very, very high ranking guy and have a full classified call where he's like, this is, you know, talk about nukes and comparing with the Chinese and the Russians. But yeah, and that's that. I would never have that opportunity if I didn't have the show. But yeah, generally, I'm not too worried about it. But obviously, the bigger the show gets, the more hate mail I get and the more angry DMs you get and the more, you know, Armenia is the best country in the world. What are you talking about? You know, that kind of stuff coming into my inbox every week.
So when you're like doing the show, like you talk about like the benefit to yourself for being able to talk to like these high ranking officials and things like that. Do you kind of do the show more for yourself or for other people? Do you find that like you're exposing these things and talking about all these things and educating people so that other people could have the information, or more so like it's a passion project for yourself and then other people are benefiting from it?
I think it's a little bit of both. Like I really enjoy this, you know, doing the show. You know, it's a great, I really enjoy talking to incredibly smart people and figuring out, you know, where Turkmenistan is going to go for the next 20 years. But it's also really interesting to be able to put that package up and give it to people as a, you know, it's kind of sampled off what you get, you know, when I've done work for state governments and whatnot. When you get like an operational brief, you get this kind of like, here's where the country is and here's what they have going and here's where their friends are. You know, that's what you get. And it's kind of modeled a little bit off that, where it's kind of like you don't have to kind of watch the whole show, but you can go click on a Turkmenistan, the episode we did on Turkmenistan, and that'll take you through, you know, what the country's about, what their exports are, what they're doing, and then, you know, where the country's going to be going over the next 20 years. And that's kind of the idea of the show, is you can use it as a crash course with some really smart people who have dedicated their entire lives to this one subject.
So I like asking this question because in some ways, like it kind of helps me figure out like motivation and things like that for doing certain projects, you know, because I have a lot of friends who will, you know, who only do what they do because one, they're good at it, and two, people like they get a lot of eyes on them for doing it. So like, would you continue doing what you're doing? I guess you kind of already had, so the question's kind of already answered because you were a ghostwriter and things like that. Like, but would you do this if you could, if you knew this would never get an audience, or at least in your lifetime no one would ever watch this, would you still do it?
Yeah. And that's the thing, when we started it, you know, we didn't have much of an audience. Like I usually kind of set some bars myself on where I want to be in, you know, 12 months with whatever project it is, to kind of see if I'm hitting the KPIs or whatnot. And the goal for this show was that we'd hit, you know, 20,000 streams within a year. And that seemed to me ridiculous. It was like, why would 20,000 people tune in to listen to me gab on and you know, that's fine. So when we cracked 500K, it was just like an added little bonus. You know, it's, you know, because the show is bigger, we can go after bigger guests now. But generally the whole, you know, I went into the show expecting almost no one to listen to it, to be more of a, you know, there'll be three or four policy wonks that will listen to it and go, that's a really interesting show. And that's it. It's just, it's insane that it's even got as far as it did.
Is the podcast sort of the plan in and of itself, or would you want to go on and do, you know, I don't exactly know what the upper echelon of conflict journalism is. Is it sort of like owning your own paper or owning your own, you know, industry, or, you know, like, do you want to be the guy above everybody, like sending out your own sort of network out into the world, or?
Possibly. I mean, for me, I, you know, to get to the next step, I guess, would just, you know, whether I do, just full-time work for the government, and which I effectively do mostly now anyway, but, you know, whether I sell the show to someone else or whether I just generally keep it going as a hobby, as a kind of a madman's diary of, you know, here's all the crazy, you know, ways that everything connects. Generally, I think the show, I just want to keep it going and keep doing what I'm doing and meet lovely people and do some, you know, interesting conversations until I get, you know, bored with it and decide to do something else. But so far it's been a really interesting thing to do.
So the show, is that like your full-time job, or you work another job and like you also do this as like on the side?
So yeah, so I do on the side, I do a foreign policy work, some ghostwriting, and also like analyzing election data and whatnot on the side. usually for our version of the Democrats over here, I guess. You know, that's generally my side job. But yeah, like this is already taking up 40 hours of my week, just this one. So right now I'm working sort of close to 90 hour weeks every week, which is why you can probably see giant bags under my eyes during most of these interviews.
I'm with you. I got, I was in the same boat a while ago, but luckily right now I just, well, one with the coronavirus, I just work from home all the time, but, and so that's also kind of why I started this, cause I felt I had a bit of extra time to start this podcast. Oh man, I had a question for you. It was a good question, I thought.
I'm impressed you're doing this off the top of your head. Usually when I do interviews, there's just, you know, I've got Matt, like there's, you know, there's just me, that's all you'll see, but there's like a whiteboard here and notes here and two pages of questions here just below the screen. And then I've got, yeah, you know, a map here as well. So I can seem smart and go, well, obviously, you know, the Docklands Peninsula is going to be an interesting place to look because I've got the giant map with it circled saying, remember to ask this. So the fact you're doing it off the cuff is incredibly impressive to me.
And so I kind of wanted to, the nature of the podcast itself and the nature of like what I do in general or what I like to do is sort of like that. Like I want to develop the type of character that, let's say I get cornered or I get asked a question like on the street. Like I want to be able to talk for as long as that person needs me to talk for about whatever that topic is, you know? So it's like, I kind of like that, being able to do it that way. Like, although I do like, I'm not like, the questions and things that you're digging into are a lot more complicated than what I'm digging into in some ways, like questions around purpose and like meaning in life and things like that. Like a lot of them are fundamentally simple questions, but the answers are insane. You know, like there's the three word question that's got everyone scratching their heads for 10,000 years is what is the meaning to life, or four word question or whatever it is. You know, it's like, it's such a simple question, but like people have written volumes on it, you know? And so, but yeah, that's, I probably should, go ahead.
Yeah, I was going to say, and that's how most big questions are. I mean, that's the thing, you know, we do on the show all the time. Like we just did a piece on who is India's greatest strategic enemy. And that could be a one word answer. You just say China. But then you go, well, it's actually a little more complicated. And even then we did an hour and a half piece and I feel like we only just scratched the surface on it. You know, a lot of questions around the world are, you know, you ask a tiny thing that you think, oh yeah, well, it's just this. And then you ask the why, and then all of a sudden you're down this giant rabbit hole for 3 weeks.
Yeah.
To figure out why it is that way. So yeah, it's interesting to see how little questions can often have dramatically huge answers.
Whenever you're like, okay, so like here in America, like if you go to a barbecue, like with your family, like it's very like, I had a barbecue with my family two weeks ago. And the first thing off the cuff is like some political conversation about the state. Like right now, America is pretty, there's a lot of contention between, I guess you call it Democrats and Republicans, and like Trump and Biden. And it's like, it's just very like hostile. And so like in my family itself is divided. Some are, they're Democrats and Republicans in my household. And so, but none of them, they only know the figureheads. They don't read any of the like policies. They don't read any books. They don't kind of dig into like theory or anything like that. So they have like a very rudimentary, like base understanding of sort of the political environment and like what it all entails. Whenever you're like, I don't know if it's the same in Australia, but I'm sure you spend enough time talking to people about politics and about, you know, foreign policy and different things like that. Do you find that, is it insufferable to talk to people who don't know anything about something but have strong opinions about it?
Well, I used to think that, but then again, I also used like figured out, you know, that you don't convert people by just going, who cares? You know, you convert people by listening to them, understanding them, and then going, look, I like what you got here. You're pretty close. I like the fact you're looking into it. But look over here, you know, this little decision of, oh, let's bring the troops home from here actually has these many wide repercussions that you don't really think about unless you're reading policy all day. In Australia, we're not as political about everything over here as the States tends to be. And we're also way more involved in United States politics than we are in our own. So in Australia, you can ask who is the deputy prime minister and no one knows. If you ask, you know, who's running for the Democratic primary, they'll give you all 28 candidates and what they stand for and everything in between. So it's a bit of a weird country like that. But yeah, I mean, obviously barbecues over here, like I grew up in a very, very conservative household. So, you know, when I went to go work for, you know, our version of the Democrats, you know, obviously, you know, my father was, you know, very kind of like, we'd have lots of policy discussions, but generally politics isn't as a divisive an issue over here as it is in the States. We're not, you know, you don't really see the like flat hagging the political flags across everywhere. Because it's a very different political system. Over here, we have lots of parties and voting is mandatory in here. You know, it's a very, very different system. So things tend to stay. And because everyone has to vote, we don't, you know, in the States, you only have, you know, you only have to get out what 30% for 30% of the hardcore Democrats and 30% of the hardcore Republicans. And that's all you have to appeal to because most of the population doesn't show up to vote. Whereas in Australia, everyone shows up. So you can't go one side or the other too far because you have to appeal to, you know, Karen, who only follows politics for 2 weeks every 3 years. And you can't go too far one or the other because she goes, well, you know, I just don't like it. It's just too complicated. So you have to kind of keep everything fairly civil. So politics is a very, very different thing over here.
Do you find that that's boring? Yeah, well, yeah, that might be true. I do like the controversy. I myself am like, I'm almost apolitical. Like I can see where like, cause I like, I read a lot of philosophy books and, major in psychology and like there. So for me, like, I like the underpinnings. Like for me, I call philosophy sort of like pure politics in the sense that like, if you talk to people about philosophy, I find that they're less defensive, even though if you talk about something like, you could talk about some abstract syllogism, which they don't really realize is actually, you know, the basis for some party platform. And you, I find that you can have a more constructive conversation when they don't necessarily understand where everything goes, you know?
Of course, and there's some fantastic work on that. You know, that one of the best ones you can watch they did in the UK in the last election cycle, and they went, you know, do you believe in this? Yes. Do you believe in this? Yes. Do you believe in this? Do you believe in this? And you get these people saying, yes, 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 yes. And then they go, these are the policies of Jeremy Corbyn, the Labour guy who's left wing. And they go, I'm not voting for Corbyn, he's a communist. And then, you know, they'd walk away. But it was really interesting. Even back here, you know, I talk to people about policies and they go, oh, that's a great policy. I love that. I love that. I love that. And they go, well, that's what this guy's doing. He goes, oh, his eyes are too close together. I don't like him. I'm not voting for him. So yeah, people, you know, if you can get the full, you've told people about the philosophies of parties, the ideas, the policies, people are actually really reasonable and sensible in debates. It's when you get into the like orange man bad, he has bad hair, ha ha ha. That's when people get defensive and the whole conversation just dribbles down into he said, she said.
I was going to ask if you think there's a guy, I think his name is John Rawls, or like his line of ethics is like Rawlsian ethics or something like that. But he developed some idea called the veil of ignorance, where like if you should design a society as if you didn't know what role you were going to take in that society. And do you think that like, I guess you kind of already answered it, but do you think that it would be beneficial if voting systems were sort of like double blind in that sense, where like you didn't know who was who or what was what? Like you did exactly what you talked about. You'd pick these policies and then like you'd say, would you vote for this candidate? And if you checked yes, then like that was your vote for that candidate kind of thing. Like, would you prefer that veil of ignorance, or do you like the personalities being tied to the politics?
No, I love that idea. Personally, I think it's great. I think that's how policy should be done. You know, people can vote on, you know, I think healthcare is a good thing. I think, you know, da, da, da. But the trouble is who writes those questions, because, you know, I can give you a bunch of leading questions. I can go, do you believe the country should be free? Do you believe that we should have Americans first? Do you believe we should have strong borders? Do you believe, you know, that we should make sure American jobs are protected? And everyone goes, oh yeah, of course, those are all good things. It's like, well, those are the policies of Donald Trump. And then, you know, even though you might not like any other policies, it's very easy to lead people down a few questions. And studying psychology, so you know that you can give people a few leading little ones and then drop them on the big one at the end.
Yeah.
And that's the trouble with if that system of, let's say we just do it on policies, who writes the questions would determine how the outcome comes out. But I love the idea of it. And I when people ask me what my perfect political system is, that's what it is. I don't like the idea of parties and figureheads and, you know, he wore the wrong tie, so I don't like that guy. I like the idea of a very policy focused world, but then again, also relies on your entire populace being really, really invested into studying policy. Yeah. And I know that, you know, for me, great, but I know that most people don't have 12 hours a week to read the legislative proposal for new tax reform funding of a separation district. You know, it's very boring stuff.
I totally agree with you. I find like, it's sort of like, one of my favorite authors, his name is C.S. Lewis. He has this quote where he talks about philosophy. He says, it's not the case that, if you're not reading philosophy or not thinking about your philosophical stances, it's not the case that you will have no philosophy. It's really the case of whether you'll have either a good philosophy or a bad philosophy. And I think in some ways that's like kind of what we talked about here. That's sort of similar in the political area as well, where it's sort of like, it's not the case that you'll have no political views. It's the case that you'll either have good or bad ones. And I guess those are value judgments. So it's like, that kind of stems back to like, ethics and things like that, you know, like what is a good political belief. But like, I always recommend people, like, at the very least, like before they say something, most people are not willing to read like Sickness Unto Death by Soren Kierkegaard or On Liberty by John Stuart Mill, like are real, you know, philosophy books, you know, like they're not willing to study logic, and people have a preconceived notion of what logic is and then what logic actually is, you know, like, and they're more willing to appeal to what they think it is, which is, you know, talking with very hard words and using what, you know, the only person that I think has become like the archetype for logic, at least in America, is Ben Shapiro. For whatever reason, whenever I mention the word logic, that's what people think of. And it's like, I don't understand like sort of where that's come from, but oh man, where was I going with this? Go ahead.
No. So look, again, people understand logic is completely different things. Like, you know, people think Ben Shapiro because he yells the word logic all the time, yeah. Even though that he usually just speaks very quickly, and 9 times out of 10, he's only debating, you know, some college freshman. And yeah. It's like, well, of course you're going to beat a poli-sci college freshman. You've had, right. You know, 14 years of media training, and you've got the, you know, you're deciding the questions as well. But, you know, that's the trouble, particularly in the school system in Australia as well, but I know the US is a bit shocking for it, is they don't, you know, the courses aren't really singled around how to learn, how to think, critical thinking. You know, they're designed to teach you, you know, the knee bone's connected to the leg bone, that kind of stuff. Mm-hmm. So you're not going to be thinking critically. Like, I know Finland right now is struggling with it because of the fact that Finland gets hit so much Russian propaganda all the time that they've had to administer philosophy classes and how to read propaganda classes into the Finnish curriculum. And it's actually had some really good results because people are being much more, you know, skeptical in what they read online, looking into things, checking the sources, doing the things that, you know, a journalist would do. You know, and it's really interesting to see how putting philosophy and logic into the curriculum is generally having a great uptick in Finland. So I would love to see that implemented in more places.
Yeah, I totally agree with you there. That's sort of what my stance is. Like, if they won't put it in the schools, at least try, and every person I meet, try and sort of like at least make philosophy not so esoteric and so ridiculous. Like, because people have like, they have these preconceived notions of what they think logic is. And like, also same thing with philosophy. Like, whenever I started studying it, I'd tell someone, oh yeah, I'm studying philosophy. I remember this explicitly. I was at a concert and I was like, this guy's like, oh, what do you do? And he's like, oh, you know, for fun. And I was like, oh, I read philosophy books. He goes, oh, me too. And he pulled out a crystal and he's like, yeah, man, crystal power. And I was like, what? Like, yeah. You know, it's not, philosophy is not crystal. I don't even understand where that connection was made, you know, but, so like, it's like, I almost find myself evangelizing, like, cause it used to not be so out there, you know, but, I always like, my stance is that if they'd returned it, they'd brought it back into the education system early on and required it, even if they required it in college as a general education, like a gen ed, at least in America, or, you know, they would call them gen eds. So they like have to take math, or you have to take math and English, I think, were the only like requirements, you know. If they required logic, rhetoric, philosophy, like those, I was unaware that they were doing that in Finland, but I would have like predicted, I guess, that it would turn out better for the society. Do you think that a lot of like issues stem from education? Like, do you think that like people could become more politically active and things like that if the education systems across the board were sort of fixed?
Of course. I honestly think there is not a single issue in the world that cannot be solved by education. You know, effectively, you know, how do we solve this problem? If we had more of an educated populace and more people studying it, then someone would probably come across the solution. You know, there isn't really a problem here I can see that does not have a problem that can be solved by education. You know, we're seeing great results with Finland, you know, like, you know, and again, it comes to educating people for real world stuff. I can play hot cross buns on a recorder, but I didn't know how to do my taxes when I left school. Go figure. You know, I really do think education is going to be the solution to a lot of this, even just teaching people to critically think. Like the amount of times that people send through the show, look, here's this 14-minute barely lit YouTube video that debunks your entire thing. I'm like, well, let's take a look at that. Man, there's no sources. None of the guests have any credibility. Not like this has made a huge logical leap here. I mean, that's the thing. If you haven't learned to critically think and go, okay, that doesn't match that, and then you can pretty easily fall for stuff. And that's, you know, yeah, my like it happened, and we're seeing it more and more, particularly with the older generation.
Yeah, I found that because there was a lot of I mean, there's like, for me, like, I'll be interested to hear your take on this, but for me, like, I think Facebook more than any other social media platforms is primarily just inundated with propaganda. Like, whenever I scroll down my Facebook feed, it's like, I just post after post. I'm like, I don't even know. Like, you look into the person who shared it, or, you know, it's got 800,000 followers, but they don't exist, basically, you know, like things like that. Like, there's no, like, it's just, there's a lot of weird things getting like shared on Facebook in particular. Like, I don't exactly know why. I guess because maybe it's tailored to the older generation. But do you find that? Go ahead.
Yes and no. So we did a big piece on Guyana, and we brought in Brittany Kaiser from Cambridge Analytica, who blew the lid off the whole Cambridge Analytica story. And effectively showing how Russia and other and private companies use things like Facebook to manipulate people, because Facebook is an amazingly powerful tool because of how specific it is. So what Cambridge Analytica could prove is that after 50 likes, they know you better than most of your coworkers. After, if you give them 100 likes, which all of this is public, they know you better than your boss or like someone who's quite like best friend. With 150 likes, they know you better than your parents know you. And with 200 likes, they know you better than your partner knows you. They have you down to the T. And for instance, they know that if they go, you know, we see in Australia, they're getting in Australia, you know, like we see people who, they don't care about tax reform. They don't care about, you know, refugees. They don't care about any of this stuff. But they would get hit with a really specific ad for people living in this town, this age, this medical, this qualification. They go, you know, this party's going to ban trucks. And he go, oh, really? That affects me. And then they completely go off of it. But it takes that. They only have to target that at 500 odd people, but really specific ones they know that'll flip. Because rather than the old system of, you know, you go on radio and you say, you know, vote Democrat because we're great at what we do, you know, it doesn't work anymore because you're going, you're shotgunning across everyone. You're hoping that one or two hits the target. Whereas Facebook, you can get right down. Like, you know, I'll sit in bed with my girlfriend and we'll be scrolling Facebook and watching the different political ads we get. You know, my ads are very, you know, this party's going to have this policy towards this particular kind of housing reform. And her ads are all like, you know, they're going to strip nursing facilities and rah, 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 because they know those are the issues that we're going to vote on. And particularly with the US, US particularly, where only 6 or 7 states really matter. You know, you only really have to target Ohio, Pennsylvania, Florida. Virginia's getting pretty blue these days, and a few others. And that's it. You've got the election because every other state is baked into the cake effectively. So Facebook is going to be the absolute nightmare to try and contain going forward, and people seem to just give all the information they want. My mother, for instance, didn't have a Facebook for 3 years because she was, I don't want them having a photo of me. The government's going to have a photo of me. And then I told her about her driver's license, and she went, the government doesn't have a photo of me. I think the fact they can micro-target so accurately is incredible. You know, like when if I've broken up with girlfriends, I will have a ad for cheap vodka and dating sites in my feed, usually within 20 minutes. It's pretty incredible.
Do you find, would you, I don't want to ask, would you encourage like restrictions and laws on something like this? Like at least on the advertising side, do you think that it should still exist and like just be reformed? Or do you think that it would be better if something like this didn't exist, like something with that like ability to, you know, narrow in on you kind of thing?
It's so difficult to say, because again, it comes down to that, who writes the policy.
Yeah.
You know, we could say, okay, Facebook is going to legislate against stuff. But let's say the Trump administration gets control of it and they legislate anything that's pro-Democrat or anything that's pro-union out of Facebook.
Yeah.
And then bam, now you've just amped up the problems. If let's say you would go, you know, the other way around, that might lead to other problems as well. You know, it's really difficult to try and legislate, and particularly being as new as a problem as all this is. I mean, like if you said to someone 10 years ago that Facebook was going to cause the problems it did, no one would have believed you.
Yeah.
So it's quite difficult to legislate for something that we really don't have an idea of how destructive and what it does yet, without wildly shotgunning around ideas. Even breaking it up, you know, like the idea that, you know, Elizabeth Warren, a few others have proposed that we break up guys like Google and Facebook, which has a lot of merits, but then do you fracture even further and have, you know, like conservative gun book and, you know, blue lives, you know, blue book or whatever it is, you know, do you fracture even further and then people get into even deeper echo chambers?
Yeah.
You know, there's a lot of things that, you know, when you write policy that will be great for the first month, but will be really bad for the next, you know, decade or so. And that's the problem. I don't think anyone really has a good solution on how to deal with this yet, because we're all shooting blind now. No one knows what's going on. And even if the moment any legislation comes in, there's a lot of very smart people who are paid to get around it. Mm-hmm. So even when Facebook says, oh, well, you know, we're not going to allow ads coming in from this particular company, well, they just changed the name of the company and they shifted across. It's playing whack-a-mole at the moment, and that's the difficulty with this.
Do you find, so you briefly touched on like echo chambers. I find that, I mean, it's one of those things that's like, you'll be on YouTube and you'll click on, I don't, you know, any video, like anything, like if you know, let's see, you click on the, like someone making fun of Trump or something like that. And then like the next video is like, Trump's policy is bad. And the next video, it's like, you just like very quickly funnels you down into this thing. And then all of your recommended videos everywhere are all in reference to these, you know, things. Like periodically I use different browsers. Like I'll do a lot of like, I'll sort of create this almost intentional echo chamber on YouTube using their algorithm, essentially by just clicking on these different videos. And then I'll go to a different browser and I'll look and see, you know, what average Joe, when they log into YouTube, first sees. And it's like, it's just wild to me that exists to the level at which it exists. I'm trying to find the question, like echo chambers, like what's your opinion on them? Like, I think they're inevitable. I think they existed even before social media, but like, maybe not to the degree they exist now, obviously, but
They're algorithms. The design, I mean, YouTube's primary aim is to keep you there for as long as possible. Yeah. Now, they used to run an algorithm saying they just show you something and here's something that's similar to that with a little bit, it's a little more popular, but then everything would eventually link to Gangnam Style because you'd watch something that's a little more popular and you eventually reach Gangnam Style. So now YouTube goes down the rabbit hole method of, as you said, you know, you watch something of, you know, here's this piece of Trump doing this, and you go further and further and further down the hole, and eventually you're in like 10 reasons why Trump is actually made by the Illuminati. You know, that's where we're at, unfortunately. And it's like, unless you're really critically thinking, it's really easy to fall down those rabbit holes. Even I've done it before. I've gone and clicked and then watched someone else's stuff, watched someone else's stuff, and then been, you know, really into this, you know, this theory of how they're sneaking nukes into this country or whatever it is. And then I have to actually pull myself, like physically take the effort to pull myself out and go, let's actually check the sources on this, because this is sounding pretty crazy now. But a lot of people don't. You know, quite often, like, you log into your friend's YouTube or you see what his recommendeds are, and it's the weirdest stuff. You know, it's like, you know, Minecraft Let's Plays and stuff. You know, why was he recommended that? You know, it's very weird to see how deep you can go from rabbit holes and just keep going by recommendeds. You really just got to pick some channels you really trust and do your research on their backgrounds and what they're doing. And, but yeah, it's super easy. And it's designed to do that. I mean, are we really going to be yelling at Google and going, "Oh, how dare your video site that relies on ad revenue get people to watch more?" That's kind of what they're going to do.
So there's like a, have you ever heard of this show called Black Mirror?
Yes. Yeah. Yes. I love Black Mirror. It's a good show.
So I don't know if you remember, there's a, I think it was Black Mirror. There was an episode where they had like a social rating system and like, you know, I think that was in, maybe it was in a different show, but essentially it's like the dystopian idea that your social media likes and all of that, like eventually it would like dictate your ability to like get houses and like, you know, you get approval for credit or loans or, you know, live in certain neighborhoods or drive certain cars or have certain jobs or date certain people. Like essentially it would be like background checks being made available to everyone, but even to a higher degree, because they could vet you based on your likes, dislikes, et cetera. Do you think that that's like a crazy conspiratorial pipe dream, or do you think that that's like something that could legitimately happen?
That's happening in China right now. China runs on what they call the social credit score. So effectively you start with 0 to 4. So, you know, if you donate to charity, your score goes up. If you share things on your Facebook page that are very pro the administration, things go up. If you work hard, things go up. If you game too much, because everything's logged, it goes down. If you spend too much money at a bar, because obviously all the banks are in the social credit score now, you know, that goes down. Now, if you, let's say, drop below a 1.5 around that area, you can't travel between provinces. You can't travel internationally. They can take your passport away. You know, a lot of employers, when they hire someone, look at their social credit score going, if you got a 3.5, fantastic. If you got a 3, well, obviously you're not that friendly on the government. We don't really want that in here. So off you go. This is a real thing in China. Now, the idea was that China didn't have as much to do with the banking system. It was a lot more cash-driven system. The idea was that this could provide a way of doing credit checks, but the system has been hijacked effectively into being this, you know, because, you know, that's the thing. If I was doing a show and I was living in China and I go, well, you know, I want to travel this year, maybe I shouldn't run this piece on, you know, what they're doing in Tibet and whatnot, because that'll lower my social credit score. And at a certain point, they can stop me from getting loans. They can stop me from buying houses, and they can stop me traveling between provinces. That seems absolutely nuts to me, but it's not that dystopian a thing. It's actually happened.
Yeah. I was only vaguely aware of it existing there. I didn't know to what extent it existed, but that is a mortifying reality. If you were living in China right now, would you comply or would you try and exit the country?
Because that's the thing. You can be a political activist and you can yell out and call out for the government, and, you know, 9 times out of 10, you won't be shot or whatever. But, you know, you're going to have to live in your basement because you're not going to be able to get the house you want. You're not going to get the job you want. You're not going to, you know, when you go for a loan, they're going to charge you twice as much interest on that loan. You know, you're not going to be in line to get what you need. You know, it's, you know, it would be that case of, you know, well, you know, I may hate the government, but do I really want to stop me and my girlfriend getting this house? Because, you know, is me calling out the government worth me paying double over 30 years for this house? Probably not. So you kind of shut up and go with it. So yeah, I would hate to say it, but I would probably, if I was living there and that was where I was going to do, I'd probably have to comply, unfortunately.
So there's this guy that I like. He wrote a book called The Praise of Folly. His name is Desiderius Erasmus. And he was like really, he lived like 500 years ago. And, but he wrote this book, The Praise of Folly. And at the time, it was at a time where like the public opinion was summed up in a quote by this guy. He says, indoors as you please, outside as custom dictates. And so Erasmus wrote this book. He wanted to criticize, he basically wanted to criticize the aristocracy and like these high level church officials. And so what he did was he wrote this whole book, sort of upside down, basically. He basically put all of the rational views in the mouth of the fool, of this jester character. And at the time, women were also sort of, their views were devalued. And so, like, at the end of the book, he signs like a postscript and says, if any of the views you found here were troubling, remember they were mouthed by a fool and a woman. And like, and so he kind of like, he packaged, and they're all incredibly rational. So like, he was speaking to this like underground population, basically, like, and so some people got it and other people didn't, you know? And so they criticized him. They're like, oh, this is a terrible book, because like, they think, you know, it was called one guy criticized him, saying, well, Mr. Erasmus has written The Praise of Folly. Now he must write The Praise of Wisdom, which if he had read the book, you know, upside down, he would have saw that it indeed was The Praise of Wisdom, essentially. But do you find, like, I guess maybe a twofold question. Do you find, one, we might start seeing more of those types of like writings pop up, like as sort of like the culture kind of bears down, like, and I don't know what your views on like cancel culture and things like that are, but as more and more people are being sort of like shut down because of what they think, do you think this sort of like underground, what do you call it? Like activism, or this underground criticism of the elites, the society at large, do you think that, one, do you think that's effective? And two, do you think we're going to start seeing more of that?
I worry things are going to splinter even further. You know, that's the thing. Back in the 60s, when we all used to watch one of four news stations, you know, when Nixon was caught doing what he's doing, all three news stations went, that was terrible. And the American populace went, yep, that's terrible. He's got to go. And today, I don't think that would have happened. And Fox News would have backed him in, run the wagons and said, no, what he just did was just, you know, it was fine, you know, blah, 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 blah. Look at this car chase. And we would have just, you know, he would probably have served out his second term. You know, I think now there's a lot of ways that, you know, unless you really want to go, like I do, I see it all the time. You know, I won't see a Fox News or I won't see a OAN or anything like that pop in my feed unless I actually go searching for it. So as much as you may think, oh, you know, there's this great piece proving, you know, that there's this corruption, or the Panama Papers, or whatever you want to go with, that's proving this, unless you go searching for it today, you're not going to find it. So I don't think pieces like that are going to have, you know, you'll get a lot of intellectuals, you get a lot of really smart people and a lot of people who are interested in it going, wow, that's mind changing. But are you really going to change, you know, Bob Smith, who works at the mechanics, who hasn't read a newspaper since 84. And that's the trouble. You know, even when, you know, things like masks, you know, if you can sit in the newsfeed that tells you that masks are going to, you know, bring the 5Gs into your brain, that's what you're going to be thinking the whole time. You know, unless you go and look it up and you realize, oh yeah, it's just a piece of cloth and it works and da, da, da. That's what it is. You know, we are stuck in very, 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 as we talked about earlier, Facebook targeted, very micro targeted stuff. Because they don't need to change everyone. They just need to change the right people's minds.
Well, I think we've been talking for an hour now. That kind of flew by. So I kind of want to cut it here, I think. And we kind of covered, I don't necessarily know where to go from where we just left off. You know, like we kind of, other than getting like further into the weeds, you know, like as far as like the social media propaganda
we'll just have to have another conversation another time and
yeah, then, but yeah, absolutely. So I think now would be a good time for us to kind of I guess say adieu till the next one. So I guess if you want to let people know where they can find you and your work.
So if you want to listen to The Red Line, which is, you know, an understanding of geopolitics and do big deep dives into one big subject, we come out each fortnight. You can find us on Apple, Spotify, theredlinepodcast.com, and most of your major platforms, whether it be, you know, Deezer, Streamer, all these kind of, and YouTube as well, because we put on YouTube because a few countries banned us already, which was, we're banning Kyrgyzstan and Armenia already, go figure.
That's a badge.
I know, I took that heart when I got that, yeah. Got that email. But you can check us out on most streaming and podcast platforms. I release a new topic each fortnight, and you can check in, and all the back catalogs pretty up to date as well. So want to listen there and me be sad and depressed for about an hour as I talk to some very smart people, that's the way to go.
Awesome. Well, Michael, thank you for coming on, and we'll definitely have you on in the future if you'd be willing to.
Would love to. Thank you so much.
Awesome. Thank you for taking the time to listen to this episode of the Will Work for Purpose podcast. If you liked what you heard here, you can find the podcast wherever major podcasts are found, as well as YouTube. So you can find it on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google Podcasts, YouTube, Stitcher, etc. Wherever you listen to your podcast, you can find this podcast. If you want to support the work that I'm doing, subscribing is a good way to help, or you can check out the merch store, and the link for that will be in the description below, and you can buy this sweatshirt that I've been wearing, which is the anti-nihilism or the anti-meaninglessness sweatshirt. So thanks for watching. Leave your impressions of the show in the comments below or wherever you happen to be listening to this. And if you want to be on the podcast yourself or want me to interview someone, you can contact me at mosley@tweakingo.com. And you can find the rest of my work at tweakingo.com. Again, thanks for listening, and I'll see you in the next one.